It is Monday, July 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, President Donald Trump travels to Europe this week for crucial talks. British Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson resigns over Prime Minister Theresa May's Brexit plan.
Theresa May increasingly seems to be looking for what we call a soft Brexit.
And new research indicates Arctic mammals are at risk because of increased shipping. It's all ahead. President Donald Trump embarks on a week-long trip to Europe Tuesday with stops in Brussels for the NATO summit, the United Kingdom, and meetings with Prime Minister Theresa May and Queen Elizabeth II, and Helsinki with a summit with his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin July 16th. The U.S. representative to NATO, Ambassador Kay Bailey Hutchison, expressed concern about what she called Russia's malign activities. Appearing on the CBS program Face the Nation, Hutchison said it is important to talk with Russia, as does the NATO alliance.
We have what's called a NATO-Russia Council, where the ambassador from Russia meets with our NATO ambassadors. Many of the foreign leaders in our alliance meet with Putin, most certainly the Europeans do. And our military does, too. But this is to deconflict. It is not to allow escalation of hostilities. And also, I think the president will encourage Vladimir Putin to start changing their behavior. We'd like for Russia to be an ally, a trading partner. But right now, we have sanctions against Russia because of their malign influence and the things they're doing that are very disruptive. So, yes, we should be talking to Vladimir Putin, and many of our allied nations do as well. But it is to try to bring them in the tent instead of constantly seeing them do these things that are attempting to disrupt us but will not.
Hutchison said America's NATO allies are responding positively to President Trump's calls for greater burden sharing, with half of the 28 other members on track to spend at least 2% of GDP on defense by 2024. Jonathan Adelman is professor of international studies at the University of Denver. International Edition's Victor Beatty asked him if trade tensions with Europe over tariffs will influence the summit.
I think they may. We see what's happening with China already. But the president has definitely modified some of the things that he's done before. He has some learning capability. But he's going to have to see whether this is something he really wants to fight over, given something very important to him, which is the 2018 by-elections. He has to seem that he's in control. And as we're now in July and the elections are being held first week in November, this is very important, how he is seen.
Will tensions also be a problem over the pullout of the U.S. with the 2015 Iran nuclear deal?
I think many people presumed that would be so. I myself thought it would probably be so. But what we're seeing is that a number of European countries are doing roughly what the Americans want them to do. We look at the French, who have not been particularly willing to go along. And yet we see Peugeot already is pulling out of Iran.
Mr. Trump goes on to London after that. Big protests expected. The president hopes to strike a free trade deal with Britain. Is that possible?
I think it is possible because both countries are in a kind of unusual situation. Theresa May now is looking for creating a unified England that will go a little slower than thought before in terms of the Brexit treaty. So I think if there were to be a place that really is needy, shall we say, right now, of a special deal, especially as it moves out of the European Union, it's the Brits.
What are you looking for in the Putin-Trump meeting?
That is the 64,000 ruble question. First of all, it's amazing to me that this is happening at all. If I were an advisor to Donald Trump, I would certainly think that the first thing we're not going and shouldn't be doing is shaking hands with Vladimir Putin, given that the Russians have done some terrible things. So I think he's got to be very careful. Whether he will or not, I don't know. But if he goes out to what is one of the most disliked countries in the world these days for Americans and shakes their hand and he's enthusiastic and so forth, could cost him politically.
That's Jonathan Adelman of the University of Denver. Helsinki will represent the first one-on-one between the Russian and American leaders, even though they've met twice on the sidelines of other meetings since Trump assumed office in January 2017. Here are some of the top news stories that are trending. Eight boys have been rescued from the flooded cave in Thailand. Turkey's president begins his new term with broader powers. Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein pleads not guilty to sexual assault. And Secretary of State Mike Pompeo makes a surprise visit to Kabul, Afghanistan. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on the VOANews.com website. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
Researchers in Australia have found that an automobile's natural vibrations can make drivers sleepy, increasing the risk of what is called drowsy driving. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration found, in the United States alone, that drowsy driving was responsible for 72,000 crashes, 44,000 injuries, and 800 deaths in 2013. In a new study, researchers from RMIT University in Melbourne, Australia, detail evidence that normal automobile vibrations at frequencies between 4 and 7 hertz can affect a driver's concentration and alertness levels a mere 15 minutes after getting behind the wheel. The researchers made their findings after testing 15 volunteers in a virtual simulation of driving on a boring two-lane highway. They say that they want to increase the scope of their study to include a larger group of people. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, President Trump will unveil his selection for the Supreme Court later today. We'll have a report. Britain is in political turmoil as Foreign Secretary Boris Johnson resigned Monday amid disagreement in the cabinet over the nation's exit from the European Union. Johnson's departure followed the resignation of Brexit Minister David Davis on Sunday. Davis called Prime Minister Theresa May's approach to the nation's exit from the EU a dangerous strategy. May addressed the House of Commons soon after Johnson's announcement.
In the 2 years since the referendum, we have had a spirited national debate. With robust views echoing around the cabinet table as they have on breakfast tables up and down the country. Over that time, I've listened to every possible idea and every possible version of Brexit. Mr. Speaker, this is the right Brexit, leaving the European Union on the 29th of March 2019. A complete end to free movement, taking back control of our borders.
I spoke with reporter Jamie Detner about the significance of Boris Johnson's resignation.
Johnson's resignation today, I'm being told by a couple of my sources within the Conservative Party, is viewed really as a move of naked ambition, that he's anticipating there will be some kind of change to her leadership, which means that she, if she loses the leadership challenge, she'll stop being Prime Minister. He really, I think, feels now it is time to be breaking with her. I think it will embolden the 60 or so hard-line, hard Brexit members of Parliament within the Conservative Party to decide to send the letters that are required, 48 are required, to the head of the backbench committee to trigger a challenge to her leadership.
Johnson has been seen, I think, by many as being very ambitious, and he's wanted to be Prime Minister. But I've also heard that some observers believe that his moment has passed. What is sort of the general perception there?
Actually, I know Boris Johnson. I was at the Daily Telegraph. We're both journalists at the same time to the Telegraph. Yes, he is a hugely ambitious man. He made no secret when he was at Oxford University that he intended to be leader of the Conservative Party and Prime Minister. He sees himself as some kind of Churchill model. I do think, though, he may well have missed the boat. He challenged, as you know, the last time when David Cameron had to resign assigned to me, Michael Gove and others to the leadership, and handled it kind of badly in terms of that leadership bid. I think that he is no longer quite the darling of the Conservative Party in the country, and he may well have missed his vote. But, you know, the problem is this is a very complicated moment.
Earlier Monday, before the Johnson resignation announcement, I spoke with Jamie Dettmer about David Davis's resignation and the continuing uncertainty.
Well, he says he resigned because he could no longer support the British Prime Minister Theresa May's approach to breaking with the European Union. He's what's called a hard Brexiteer. He wants a clean break, basically, from the European Union. And Theresa May increasingly seems to be looking for what we call a soft Brexit. She's got this plan whereby Britain can still be part of what's called a single market in goods, but not have to accept the other principles of the EU, like freedom of movement or the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice, and being able to negotiate free trade deals with other countries outside the EU. So on Friday, we had this big meeting of the cabinet. She put forward her plans to be part of the single market, a strange cherry-picked deal she's trying to persuade the EU to accept. Everyone signed on to it, but then last night, just before midnight, David Davis resigned. We'd expected a smash-up, actually, for weeks. There are two kinds of negotiations going on here. One is a negotiation within the governing Conservative Party, which is very split about how to break with the EU, and many members don't want to break with the EU at all. And then we have this strange negotiation going on between a British government, which isn't being clear about what it wants out of its break with the EU and what kind of future relationship with the EU, negotiating with the EU at the same time in very vague ways. An interesting example about David Davis is, even though he was the Brexit minister, he felt very sidelined, and he's only had 4 hours of discussions this year with the chief EU negotiator, which is a bit strange when you're in charge of the Brexit negotiations as the British minister.
Well, is a soft Brexit really Brexit? Because it almost sounds like the pro-Brexit faction wants sort of, you know, to remain somewhat in the EU, but they don't want to do the obligations that the other EU countries are having to comply with.
It's actually deeply complicated because the country is divided in half in one way between wanting to leave the EU and wanting to remain in the EU. Those who are wanting to break with the EU are also not entirely clear about what kind of future relationship they want with the EU, and opinion polls have suggested that quite a few people who voted for Brexit a year and a half ago, you know, are now considering maybe they want to be part of the EU but not quite being part of the EU. So it's a very bizarre situation. It is very hard for the EU to negotiate with the British while, one, they're very confused about what they want, and they don't seem to accept the idea that they can't really cherry pick. I mean, this is one of the problems for Brussels. If they give a special kind of deal to the Brits in terms of they don't have to be part of, you know, European justice system, they don't have to have freedom of movement, a whole load of other rules, then the other members could start cherry-picking as well, and the whole thing will fray and collapse. So Brexit's never been very clear what Brexit is. I mean, in terms of the question that was asked of the British public to vote in the referendum, it just said, do you want to leave the European Union? But there's lots of other things that could happen. They could be like Norway and be a member of EFTA, which is another European grouping which is aligned with the European Union. So in fact, the question was a question that was too vague.
Jamie Dettmer reporting. President Trump will announce his nominee for the Supreme Court Monday to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. The announcement is likely to set off a major confirmation battle in the Senate, where Republicans hold a narrow majority and where opposition Democrats are planning to wage a fight over Trump's court pick. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more from Washington.
During a campaign rally in Montana, President Trump sought to build expectations among supporters for his upcoming Supreme Court announcement.
As you know, there's now a vacancy on the Supreme Court. And if you turn in Monday at 9 o'clock, I think you're going to be extremely happy with the selection, right? And they're all great. They're all great.
Trump will nominate a replacement for retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. Though generally conservative, Kennedy was a critical swing vote in a number of high-profile cases, including same-sex marriage and upholding the right to an abortion. Democrats have vowed to resist a nominee who could swing the high court further to the right, including Senator Amy Klobuchar of Minnesota.
So it makes it all the more important that we get someone that is going to be a person of integrity and someone that's going to make a decision based on precedent, based on the rule of law, and not someone who's ideological.
Kennedy's record of casting critical votes in key cases leaves a void on the high court, says analyst Jonathan Turley.
He leaves the court in a calcified state of a hardened left and right with nobody in that middle position.
Conservatives now see a chance to solidify a majority on the Supreme Court for years to come, says expert John Fortier.
I think many on the right feel in particular that Anthony Kennedy, while broadly on the conservative side, was you know, not as consistent as he might have been, and that the nominee of Donald Trump will have the court be much more consistently five votes in the conservative direction.
A firmly conservative nominee will spark a high-stakes political battle in the Senate, says legal analyst Paul Schiff Berman.
I think that we probably have never seen an appointment process that will be as contentious as this one, given the importance of Kennedy's position on the court and the increasingly polarized state of the nation.
Trump's nominee must be confirmed by the Senate, where Republicans hold a narrow 51-49 seat majority. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. Bringing you news as it happens. Listen to Africa News Tonight, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
Hi, this is Larry London, the host of VOA's Border Crossing. I feature music and interviews with your favorite artists from all around the world. And you can not only listen, but you can interact live with us here in Washington, D.C. Border Crossings comes to you Monday through Friday at 1500 UTC GMT on VOA.
This is International Edition. The polar bear may be the classic poster child for climate change, but it's far from the only animal threatened by a warming Arctic. Because the region is warming 2 to 3 times more quickly than the rest of the planet, the rapidly melting sea ice is opening new shipping lanes. New research suggests increased vessel traffic through Arctic waters is putting other animals at risk. Sadie Witkowski reports.
Maritime traffic is dramatically increasing in the relatively untouched Arctic Ocean as receding sea ice clears the historically dangerous Northwest Passage and the Northern Sea Route along Russia's northern coast. The effect on the fragile ecosystem caught the attention of Donna Hauser from the University of Alaska, Fairbanks.
We're on the precipice. We're poised for a lot of vessel traffic to increase in the Arctic, and so part of what motivated this study is to understand where we're at and where we need to go.
The marine biologist was interested in assessing the vulnerability of Arctic marine mammals to shipping activity to protect both the species and the people who rely on them.
All of these species are really important traditional resources for the indigenous communities throughout the Arctic, as well as in Alaska and the Alaskan Arctic in particular.
Hauser and her co-authors looked at 7 Arctic species, including seals, whales, and polar bears. They created a vulnerability measure based on a combination of the animal's exposure to shipping traffic and its general sensitivity. They limited their assessment to September, when the sea ice is at its lowest point and most ships pass through Arctic waters. Their research found that narwhals and other whale species were the most vulnerable to late summer ship traffic, and polar bears were the least, with walruses and seals in between. Co-author Kristen Lydra of the Polar Ice Institute explained why narwhals and other cetaceans are especially affected.
Ships, in general, generate underwater noise, and that underwater noise is a disturbance for marine mammals, especially different whale species that rely on sound to pretty much do everything.
Narwhals in particular are at risk because of a combined effect of their high exposure and sensitivity. This puts the so-called unicorns of the sea in the most perilous position of all the Arctic marine mammals, with other whales facing similar but less extreme circumstances. Polar bears, on the other hand, seem to be the best equipped to deal with the late summer vessel traffic.
At that time of year, polar bears tend to be either on land or they've followed the pack ice north.
Hauser pointed to a second reason the bears were less vulnerable.
They don't use sound in the same way as the other marine mammals do. And so some of those things that make the other species sensitive to vessels aren't as big of a factor for polar bears.
This is the first study to compare effects of increased ship traffic across the major Arctic marine mammal species and determine which might be most in need of conservation efforts. In order to help protect these sentinel species, and whales in particular, the authors suggest requiring ships to move at slower speeds to reduce collisions with whales. In addition, placing limits on the amount of noise vessels can make will protect whales' delicate hearing. The Marine Mammal Commission's Randall Reeves recognizes the need for research on the Arctic mammals' changing landscape.
It's not realistic to think that we're going to stop people from taking advantage of these passages through formerly pristine regions, so the ships are going to go there.
By understanding which marine mammals are at risk, researchers can help plan for an uncertain future. Sadie Witkowski, VOA News, Washington.
And that is our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States is set to apply maximum economic and diplomatic pressure on Iran to induce Iran's leaders to change their destabilizing policies, including their support for terrorism, missile proliferation, and impoverishment of the Iranian people. U.S. sanctions targeting Iran's automotive sector, trade in gold, and other key metals will snap back on August 6th. Sanctions targeting Iran's energy sector and petroleum-related transactions with the Central Bank of Iran will be reimposed November 4th. U.S. State Department Director of Policy Planning Brian Hook told reporters that the U.S. goal in relation to energy sanctions is to increase pressure on the Iranian regime by reducing to zero its revenue from crude oil sales. The U.S., he added, is working to minimize disruptions to the global market, but we are confident that there is sufficient global spare oil production capacity. Director Hook pointed out that U.S. sanctions do not now, nor have they ever targeted humanitarian goods.
Our sanctions pressure the Iranian regime into changing its behavior, and they do not target the Iranian people. The United States does not sanction the export of food or medicine to Iran.
In addition to applying economic pressure, another priority for the U.S. is standing in solidarity with the Iranian people, the longest-suffering victims of the regime.
The average Iranian today is struggling to afford basics like water, bread, and eggs. At the same time, the Iranian regime is squandering millions of dollars on violent misadventures abroad. These serve no purpose other than to prolong pain and suffering of men, women, and children in Iran and elsewhere in the Middle East.
Mr. Hook pointed out that since the United States withdrew from the Iran deal in May, the U.S. has sanctioned 53 individuals and entities for human rights abuses, proliferation activities, or acts of terrorism, including Sadegh Larijani, head of the judiciary. That designation demonstrates, he said, the United States will target those responsible for human rights abuses at the highest level of the Iranian government. As the nationwide protests in Iran confirm, the Iranian people are rightly frustrated with the regime, Director Hook said, and the United States stands with them. A people with as rich a history and as deep a culture as the Iranian people deserve a government that treats them with dignity.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.